Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features a conversation between Jesse Eisenberg and John Raymond from Woodstock in 2015. Best known for his roles in movies like The Social Network and Now You See Me, Eisenberg's acting career is an unusual mix of blockbuster movies and independent films. We brought him together with writer John Raymond on stage because Eisenberg starred in Raymond's 2013 independent film Night Moves, filmed right here in Oregon. Eisenberg was at Woodstock to talk about his book Bream Gives Me Hiccups, an eclectic collection of short, hilarious fiction. While acting made Eisenberg famous, he's been writing all his life, and in addition to this book, he's the author of movies and stage plays. In this conversation, these two writers are at once self-deprecating and generous, and we get to enjoy their chemistry as they talk about acting, writing, and filmmaking. Raymond's casual interviewing style disguises his deep knowledge of Eisenberg's writing and of the art of making work that is both entertaining and meaningful. Some language in this episode is explicit and may not be suitable for all audiences. Now, from Woodstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2015, here's Jesse Eisenberg and John Raymond in conversation.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming here.
I have introductory remarks if you would like to be introduced properly. I mean, everyone I'm sure knows Jesse.
If they don't know by now, you know.
Here, I'll just read your thing here.
Okay.
Jesse Eisenberg is an Academy Award nominated actor, playwright, and contributor for The New Yorker and McSweeney's. He's the author of three plays, Asuncion, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Okay. The Revisionist and The Spoils, which won the Theater Visions Fund Award. Eisenberg's acting credits include The Social Network, Now You See Me, Adventureland, The Squid and the Whale, The Double, and The End of the Tour. There's a notable...
Did you write that?
No, this was given to me read. But yeah, there's a, you know...
Okay, John and I met because I was in a movie that he wrote called Night Moves.
It doesn't make the list, you know.
I didn't write that. In my bio, it just says Jesse was in Night Moves.
But, exactly. Thank you.
You got the extended one, which for some reason excludes
clearly,
it.
Yeah, it was too much for them to handle.
Yeah.
Okay, so forthcoming acting credits include Batman versus Superman, neither of which are you.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Breams Gives Me Hiccups is his first book, which is why we are here.
Also, neither one of those are me.
And there's no Night Moves on the back of that either.
So wait, do you also want to say about yourself?
Oh, and I, yeah, of course. I mean, I know you all. My name is John Raymond. I am a writer and screenwriter and also a board member of Literary Arts. And I would like, I'll take 1 second to just congratulate all the Literary Arts people who have worked so hard to put this on and all the volunteers. Their work is amazing. I know Jesse because he acted in a film that I wrote with the director, Kelly Reichert, called Night Moves. It was a eco-terror thriller, and Jesse blew up a dam in Southern Oregon. In fact, the first time I met Jesse was in a yurt on an organic farm in Southern Oregon. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if you remember that, but the big problem that, like, it was an interesting time. Like, we were barely introduced because there is this very menacing wasp in your yurt. I don't know if you remember that at all.
Are you talking about a Gentile?
Yeah. I mean, Kelly, yeah. You were surrounded by them.
To me, they're all menacing. Yeah. Which is why I asked to hold this event in a temple.
Yeah. Don't look at the stained glass. Yeah. It was. We eventually found a way to get that menacing wasp out of there.
Right. Yeah. And I've loved your writing. I read your book of short stories, Livability, and I saw Old Joy, which is the. Adapted from one of those stories, and as an actor, we'll say, like, so lucky to get to work on something that you've written, because John writes with a subtlety that seemingly no other Hollywood movie employs.
Yeah, that's money in the bank right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Get me that guy who's super subtle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, this book is, it's a brilliant and amazing book, and it is being billed as a collection of short stories, but in fact, it's a very diverse grouping of, you know, short plays and thought experiments and moral conundra, and it does so many different and amazing formal things in a very short amount of time. One of the stories I read in Willamette Week, you actually wrote in Portland, Oregon. Is that true?
That is true. Yes, I had to. Yes, I was waiting for 4 hours for my plane kept being delayed, which you probably know that experience well here because of the rain. And so I was trying to write a story about a Thanksgiving dinner from the perspective of a 9-year-old boy who's taken to a vegan family's house for dinner, which I based on my own family. My family does not have Thanksgiving. We have Thanksliving, which is where we actually adopt turkeys and put pictures of the turkeys on the table.
That really is a real family thing.
My family thing.
Fantastic. All right. See, I thought that was like perhaps a Portland, like that we had inspired something in Portland.
No, we have liberals on the East Coast too. Yes, we have kooky vegetarians in New Jersey as well. You guys have popularized what my family has been doing for a long time. You know, not shaving in the places you're supposed to shave. Wearing glasses thicker than your prescription requires. And so I was trying to write that, and I just happened to be in Portland when I had to write it, and it was perfect because the town seems to, you know, elicit that. And I love being here. Now, we did the movie in Medford. I made sure to come to Portland because I'm a Blazers fan, unrelated to having shot here. I'm a Blazers fan. And so, I mean, that's not pandering. I mean, since Clyde Drexler, I've been a huge Blazers fan. So that's pandering. So I came here to go to a game and ended up, my flight kept getting delayed. So that's what I wrote here, and it seemed like the perfect place to write a story about Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that was great, yeah. You guys have Robin Lopez now, is that true?
Yeah, he came to New York. I mean, you guys unloaded everybody, so, but it's a great team nonetheless, because we have heart.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of people have discussed Woody Allen as a influence on your writing in some ways. Let's talk about Woody Allen for a moment. There are a few Woody Allen things to talk about.
Sure.
You have a long relationship with Woody Allen. Is that sort of true?
Yes. I mean, my relationship with him predates his relationship with me.
A one-way relationship.
Yes, still a relationship. Yes. I'm also dating Cheryl Teagues, but and have been since I'm six. But she doesn't know.
Now I'm seeing his face on her body, and it's really
you could understand why I like both of
fighting.
Them. So just very briefly, when I did not grow up with the New Yorker magazine or Woody Allen. I have smart parents, but we're not interested in anything cultural. We watched this movie, All I Want for Christmas. That was which was like a kind of Christmas movie about divorce. That was the only thing we ever did that was cultural. Yeah. So when I turned like 15 and I started acting in plays, somebody gave me a Woody Allen DVD, and my mind was open.
What was it?
I think it was Husbands and Wives was the first movie I saw, which I was so glad I did because it turned me on to, I think, in my opinion, my favorite period of Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Crimes and Misdemeanors, Husbands and Wives, Hannah and Her Sisters. That to me is the best work that he's, or at least the most appealing to me. And I loved it. I read everything that he's written, and then I watched all of his movies. And I think what was mainly interesting to me about him was that this was somebody who was not kind of censoring their interests to appeal to an audience that might like humor. He was writing about all the things that he knew about and that he was interested in, whether it be kind of obscure literature or Freudian psychology or kind of an overbearing mother or the Knicks. It was always just about what he was interested in. And I thought this is the best way to write because if you write about something kind of that in a funny enough way, then it doesn't matter how esoteric the references are. People will enjoy it, and maybe they'll then be interested in those things too. Now, that's kind of like an unnecessary byproduct, and I'm sure it's not his intention, nor is it mine, to have people then suddenly interested in the Knicks, but it's but it just means that they don't have to know about it to get the jokes. And then he's, you could see when you read his stuff, oh, he's probably more entertained than anybody else is by it, and that's infectious.
Yeah, no, he seems delighted. Yeah. Right. And so, okay, and then so that led then to some creativity on your part, is that true?
Yeah, yeah. So then I was 16 years old, and I wrote a, I read that he changed his name to Woody Allen at that age, and I thought it would be interesting to write kind of like, inspired by him, a modern day story of somebody at 16 changing their name to Woody, him changing his name to Woody Allen, but set in a modern day. And so I wrote a screenplay, and I worked on it every day throughout high school, and all the kids in my class like knew about it, and I was testing jokes on them. And it was like a labor of love for the, like the high school. And then like somebody at the high school read it, sent it to an agent, and then sent that agent sent it to his manager, and then I got a cease and desist letter once a month. And it was like the kind of thing like I was just awaiting a response because I heard that Woody Allen has the script, so I was expecting him at some point to knock on my door and say, you know, I loved it and we're going to go into production with, you know, but so my family was like kind of, you know, we had like, you know, like some Manischewitz out for Elijah, but for Woody Allen in case he would ever show up. And then I see the Jewish jokes go over well here because we haven't yet migrated to Portland, so it's still a novelty. this is, I won't tell anybody about it, so I can have it for myself. no, there's nothing there. So anyway, so then my father came in with like a letter that he had opened. He didn't know what it was. He came into my bedroom from very exciting news. What was it? We heard back from Woody Allen. Oh, that's great. What did he say? Well, he's suing you. So then, but we were thrilled anyway. My family like framed the letter, so I had two cease and desist letters. And then I put it away, and then I started writing movie scripts in earnest, but they were... You know, it's funny, it's similar to what we were talking about backstage. Like, I wrote, like, I started writing when I was 18, 19, 20, like, commercial movie scripts, and they were not good, but they were, like, very commercially accessible, and I, like, optioned some to some companies, and I was an ambitious young person, so I would do all the rewriting, but it was all these kind of lateral changes to no end, you know. Oh, this person's manager likes the script, can you make the character more likable? Uh-huh. And then I met Bob Odenkirk, the comedian, and he... I asked him to read one of my scripts, and he said, this is terrible. Why are you writing this? Write something personal. Everything you like is personal. Write something personal. So then I started writing plays and stories that were personal and kind of got back to what I originally liked about what Woody Allen was doing.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. And so, and you're just fresh off of making a movie with Woody Allen, too. Is that the case? That's what the internet tells me.
Yes, we're actually in the middle. My last day is this Tuesday, so I fly to LA tomorrow, and we finish Monday and Tuesday.
Do you get in any edits or anything? Does he ask for, you know, do you get to improvise at all?
Every scene, because the way he shoots the scenes is he doesn't like to do any editing in his scenes, so he requires the actors to fill in all the gaps in the dialogue with improvisation. So
wow, really?
You end up improvising in a Woody Allen movie. It's the most surreal experience, because he'll say, oh, just say whatever you want. And I say, I don't want to say anything here. Whatever yeah. you tell me to say.
yeah.
Like, you're Woody Allen. Like, we're all just trying to do, like... bad versions of what you do well. So what should I say? He says, oh, I don't care. Just don't say what I wrote because I just wrote that quickly. He'll say that sometimes.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Most of the script is great, but occasionally there'll be a line that he says, oh, don't say that. I realize now it's not going to work. And so he just throws you into it. And then what I think he loves and what he's actually striving for is mistakes and, you know, little errors and stumbles and stutters because he thinks that makes it more authentic.
I never would have thought that's how he did it.
I wouldn't have thought that either, yeah. But I think now if you watch his movies, you can probably be able to see where, you know, Woody Allen thought of it and where I thought of it. You know, you could see yeah. the references go from Joyce to Seuss.
yeah. One of my favorite sections of the book is a series of very... mean-spirited letters written by a college freshman to her former, like, guidance counselor, I guess.
Right.
To me, it's just a really beautiful and hilarious character that has been evoked. I wonder if you would read a tiny bit of it, just so, I mean, people should hear a little bit of what the book sounds like, right?
Sure, that is offensive, though. That part is so offensive to me. I mean, I would do it, but...
Well, no, that's part of what's so great about it. Okay. I mean, she's an offensive and horrible person, and yet you can't help but love her.
Sure, there's also... there's like they're inundated with footnotes, like very complicated footnotes.
Well, that was part of my curiosity, is how you'd read it that way.
I've never read these.
Just give us a taste. Give us a little flavor.
Okay, so wait, this is an 18-year-old girl, college freshman, writing to her guidance counselor from high school, who's the only person she ever liked, and she's full of vitriol and bad grammar. So this is it. Okay. Dear Miss Rita, sometimes things seem f***ing awful, but if you look at them a different way, they're actually not. Footnote, you know?
He just did the David Foster Wallace movie, too, so, you know,
well, yeah, exactly.
I see the influence there. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, exactly. I had a really weird night this week that made me think a lot about my life and my parents and what I want to be when I get older. Footnote. Which is actually coming pretty soon if you think about it. You probably didn't think you would be so old when you were my age, right? Okay, here's what happened. Slutnik and I don't have class on Wednesday. So her roommate is named Rebecca Slutnik, but she calls her Slutnik. Slutnik and I don't have class on Wednesday. Footnote. Actually, Slutnik never has class. Get it? Because she's a slut. So we were just hanging out in our room. Footnote, I should also mention here that SN's been really tolerable recently. We're actually getting along and she's not being such a massive douchebag. And Slutnik was showing me the grossest video of a snake eating a whole crocodile. It was so disgusting, but I couldn't stop watching it. And just before the end of the video, there was a knock on the door. It was kind of a silly knock, like where you knock a few times in a funny beat and wait for the other person to finish the beat. And SN opened the door, and two old fugly people were standing there grinning like idiots. And Slutnik squealed, "Oh my God, what are you guys doing here?" And the old fugly said, "We wanted to surprise you and take you to dinner." And then all three fat ugly people were holding hands and jumping up and down. And that's when I realized I was looking at Mr. and Mrs. Slutnik. The dad looked like Chef Boyardee, but if he was uglier and more Jewy, and not wearing a chef's hat. And the mom looked like Slutnik if she kept getting fatter and uglier and just went through life without ever making any of the right moves. And it's horrible.
Well, the thing that's great is it really warms up as it goes. Like,
oh yeah, yeah. She's a very hurting
almost
person.
Almost sweet in a little, in a she page feels, or two. Yeah.
Yes, she feels the need to make fun of everybody because she's dying inside. And they all start like horrible, and she's ultimately striving for like love. She ends up falling in love with the family and
yeah,
hoping
they go
that,
to they go to Olive Garden, and it's like a really lovely thing.
Yeah.
But so I don't know. I mean, I found it to be that character. What's her name again?
Her name is Harper Yablonsky.
Yablonsky. It's one of those like counterintuitive things where just the more horrible she is, the more lovable she becomes in some bizarre fashion. And I wonder how you got to her character. Like, what was the genesis of that batch of stories, and like, how did they develop?
The genesis was my little sister went to college and had roommates for the first time, and she's a sweet, kind of normal, unassuming little kid. And then she went to college and called me after a week and said, "My f-ing roommate just sat on my f-ing bed with her f-ing jeans that she wore to the f-ing diner." I was like, I had never heard her say f-ing or diner or roommate or jeans. I was so shocked. I could not believe this sweet little kid had turned to such rage. And then I realized, oh, the kind of, you know, this difficult transition that we all make to these different stages in our lives, we react to things usually with kind of these, you know, histrionic, you know, emotions that we didn't even know we had. So I told her to calm down, and then, you know, she has self-awareness to know that what she was saying was absurd and her tone was ridiculous and unsuited to the situation, but... I said, well, you know, why don't you, I was trying to think of a way for her to kind of cope with this new transition in her life. And I said, why don't you write a funny blog called My Roommate Stole My Ramen, where you detail all of the kind of offenses that your roommate has.
Yeah.
And so she was laughing and she thought it was a funny idea. And then she said she ultimately didn't want to do it. So I said, okay, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I want to use that kind of character, this girl who's just full of rage because she's having difficulty transitioning to this new thing in her life. And it's something that I could relate to. I'm normally kind of a calm person, but I know when I feel kind of out of place or alienated, or I feel like I can't find my footing, or I can't kind of figure out where I belong, I have this kind of this boiling rage. And what's great about this character is that she appears totally docile. She almost has no dialogue. She's totally passive. In fact, in this thing, they ask her, do you want to go to the Olive Garden? And she says, oh, I don't think so. She doesn't, but even though she loves the Olive Garden, she just doesn't, she's very sweet outwardly, but inside she's hating them. So that's why she accuses them of horrible things, you know, like she makes fun of them being overweight or unattractive, you know, things that nobody would ever think to say, you know, is horrible. But she's just so full of rage. And the angrier she is, you suspect, the more sad she is.
Yeah, no, like the more vulnerable, weirdly, she becomes. So just to go a little deeper into the process of it, did these kinds of, vitriolic monologues come quickly and, did you write them in a burst or are they things that you piece together as, you know, new insults enter your mind or new channels of rage happen to you? Like how did you build those?
This one in particular, I tried writing for 2 or 3 years and it was never ever working. I tried doing different diary entries. I tried doing monologue forms. I tried doing letters to different people. And then I was actually doing that movie about David Foster Wallace and I was reading something that he had written and there were tons of endnotes. And it suddenly hit me, that's what it is. The key to this is going to be endnotes, because here's somebody who's detailing her life, and the only way she can fully express everything that's going on in her mind is to have notes that kind of are extraneous but important to her. So we see little things like jokes, like, you know, like, as that's not, doesn't warrant a footnote.
Yeah.
But to her, it warrants a footnote, because she's impressing upon this guidance counselor how upset she is. Do you know how bad it is? And so once I realized that, they came out and I deleted everything I had written, which I had written a lot. And I was also doing that movie, and in that movie, my character is feeling all of those feelings. Like, and I felt them as an actor. I felt like my character was like secondary in the movie, but also the role is secondary to the other role. Like all of these feelings of feeling frustrated.
Yeah.
And I channeled them in both the movie, and then I would go home every night and write this, and on weekends I would write this, because I was feeling angry both in my character.
That's
so
great, yeah. In the film, Jesse plays a journalist who's profiling the famous author, David Foster Wallace, and there becomes a really fascinating kind of psychodrama between them as writers at different levels of fame and
that's
stuff,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, so in this, like, Slutnik, her roommate, has everything worked out in the same way that in that movie I felt that, you know, Wallace, who's a real person, but, you know, in the movie at least, he felt like he has everything worked out. And so I think I was probably channeling that, you know, that feeling. Now, the two things seem unrelated as, like, kind of finished products, but that's the nature, as you know from writing different things, that's the nature, they each infect, you know, whatever you're doing seems to infect everything.
Yeah. That's so interesting. So yeah, I mean, I guess I should like ask further about this this kind of parallel between the writing and the acting. I mean, is that a frequent thing that the acting will somehow irrigate the writing, and that this kind of traffic is and do you view the writing even as a form of acting or vice versa?
Yes, because it's all playing characters. Like, I could play that character permanently. I could be her if I was required to write a 1,000-page novel in her voice. I'd be able to, because I know every little part of her mind. It would, after a while, not be effective anymore, or less interesting. It would probably be decreasingly interesting. But the first section of stories, which are the title stories, is about this 9-year-old boy. And I was acting in a movie called The Double when I started writing that. And in The Double, I play kind of this emotionally stunted man. And I also play his like kind of aggressive doppelganger. And the story is about this kind of sweet 9-year-old boy who I could relate to, and also his brash mother. And so I started writing those, and then it took me the next few years to finish them. But that's, so yes, oftentimes it will infect that. And one of the great things about acting is it forces me to kind of get into the emotional experience of a character in a way that if I was maybe sitting in my room trying to conjure it, it would be either less effective or more inefficient.
Yeah. Do you read the stuff out loud?
Yeah, always.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, always. Because I want to make sure, especially if it's first person. Now, so like, I don't do well with third person, whereas you are like one of my favorite writers of third person, because you can describe things that, to me, I miss. I never look around at any of my settings. I'm constantly just looking down at the ground to make sure I don't trip. I don't even know. I looked for a minute. I saw there's up there, but otherwise I'm just looking at the ground. And then I'll read something like yours, and I'll just think, how did he know to look at the ceiling? It just would never occur to me.
Yeah, well. When there's nothing else going on in here, then, you know.
No, to me, I have this sense that I'm just going to be beaten up. So I just want to, I know where the exits are, and then I look at the ground. And so I can't really describe sunsets or teacups. I could usually describe carpeting and fears.
Would you want to take up the challenge of doing a novel in a third person? Like, does that interest you at all, just as purely as a, like...
No, I wrote like a novel when I was in college, and it's in the third person, but it's what I would call like a kind of very, like a mocking third person. Like where I, as the omniscient narrator, was mocking him, like, because no one liked Albert, he didn't have anywhere to go, that kind of thing. Like, yeah. And it was funny because I was like almost as a writer making fun of the character, but I didn't finish it. And I don't think I would be able to do that because I don't trust that my version of the sunset is better than yours. I think, and I'm not saying that one's is not better. I think yours, like John Raymond's, actually is better. So like you should do that. Like I don't feel like I could do that well enough. But I do feel like what I can do well enough is kind of like go on a kind of tangent of like a neurotic mindset. I think I could do that. I think I could do that like as well as anybody else. So like I found that I could do that well, and I do that.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how far. Yeah. How about even longer form? You know, character, neurotic characters like that. Does that interest you? I mean, you know, to do a Saul Bellow thing or something like. You know,
right.
To get something like. Bigger and thicker that way.
Yes, I could do that. I write plays, and like in my last play was a real kind of character study of one guy. So that's, you know, in a way a longer form thing. And then I end up playing the character, and we do it for 6 months. So that's like a real kind of fully physicalized manifestation of a single character. And I like doing that. And I imagine that's what I'll do as a fiction writer as well, that it will end up being character-based stuff, just because that's how my mind works. The only B+ I got in college, I'm not saying I'm such a great student, but I only took two classes at a given time so that I would always do okay, and was in a short story workshop, and I was trying to write, and I couldn't find my voice. This is like 12 years ago or something, so I couldn't find my voice, and it was all because I was trying to write there. I was trying to describe, I spent two pages trying to describe a black and white cookie, and I realized I was writing a Yelp review, so like...
But I could see a series of Yelp reviews actually being a productive.
Right. What I should have done is describe why the character, like why I or a first person character was like made upset by a black and white cookie. That would be like an interesting take that I would be able to handle well.
Yeah.
What I wasn't able to handle well was, you know, the kind of the crackling white frosting shone off the gleaming sunset. Like I immediately, as soon as I'm trying to describe anything that's not in the first person, my mind immediately just goes to sunset. I was like, oh, that, like, want to see how the sunset reflects off this black and white cookie. Or, he always wanted to play basketball. It was like a sunset to him, gleaming off. I just think, like, that's what people have to describe. Yeah. Her breasts shone like sunset and...
And now, are you adapting this for a television?
Yes, Amazon optioned my first short stories, which are like the little boy short stories, and I wrote several scripts for them, and they asked me to make all these changes, and so now we're in like the midst of like making all these kind of lateral moves. You know, oh, change this guy's name one letter. How come? Oh, we just thought of it. Oh, yeah. But I originally thought of the guy's name. Yeah, I know, but we like pay for this stuff, so we were just like wondering if you could change it one letter. So then so I have to go and like rechange it one letter, which is easy. You just do like the find and replace thing, but still, it just seems pointless nonetheless.
Should we solicit questions at all from people?
Sure.
Do people have
Hi.
Questions? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm just really interested in going back to the Woody Allen. How?
Perfect. That's... on everyone's mind here. That's great.
That's so funny. That's so funny. Yes, good.
What was the leap from he was disgusted with you to he invited you to be an actor? I just want to understand, was there a lunch between the two events or what?
Yeah.
We had a mediator and no. I'm sure that he never heard anything about me, scripts about him. I can imagine that that his lawyers are very litigious because he is so iconic, and he's also been through a series of traumatic legal processes that I can imagine they nip everything in the bud. So I don't think he ever knew about it, and I think if I told him, I don't think he'd care. He has such an unusual personality. He is kind of so forward-moving. You can tell by somebody who's so prolific that they probably don't have so much interest in kind of thinking and talking about things that occurred. He's just very interested in kind of moving forward. So I never brought it up, and we have a very kind of, you know, nice, casual working relationship.
Other questions out there?
Hi, how you doing, all? Yes, no, we know each other. That's why I said it like that.
You played a relatively senior person in the end of the tour, and also a father in Louder Than Bombs. So you always talking about that you are not very interested in youth culture. So I want to know how you see the breakthrough in your acting career.
Oh, in youth culture? Well, I think I missed youth culture. I never had any interest in, like, all my friends were always older, and then it's funny, like, in the book I kind of write about thing. I write using, like, oftentimes, like, text messaging and email conversations, and this is something that to me still feels like a very juvenile way to communicate with people. People talk about very sophisticated things, but once you do it with text messaging, where like the predominant font is a smiley face, it feels just so juvenile. So in the book, there's like a series of like text messages about Cameroonian separatists, but people are, but they're using like the kind of like abbreviations like AOL, LOL, like an AOL, like other things, anything that ends with OL, you know. and it just to me seems like it's funny to me to kind of like juxtapose like what I see as like the forms of communications that youth people, that, you know, the young people use, young people, I mean, I'm young, but then like, and I'm sure that if my father was writing a book, he would talk about me on my cell phone outside, you know, like a heathen talking outdoors. Look at his apostate Nokia with no cord. So I'm sure it's like a relative and generational kind of disgust we have for the new things. But to me, there's nothing sillier than text message. But so how do I talk about youth culture? So okay, yeah, that's what I can think about. Nice to see you. Yes, I just heard you in Madison.
Oh, all right.
Hi, thanks, all. Thanks for coming here. Yeah, hi. Do you want to say something?
I noticed in a couple of your movies, like, well, we'll take Zombieland for instance. You played like a like almost like a nervous character, and then you kind of built into like a badass kind of sort of way. And then like the movie you did with Tracy Morgan, you were kind of like a young, like you were developing, you know. And then how does that translate into your books? Do you allow your characters to develop like from like a meek kind of person to like that more badass kind of way?
In my plays, like in my last play, the character was a real kind of tortured, arrogant, horrible person, and I feel like I can relate to that because I feel like I suppress that. Like I suppress a kind of like, well, probably like all healthy people, you suppress like the kind of the bad behavior, but I love being able to kind of enact it in fictional things because it can be cathartic, and I could also kind of, let's say, therapeutically or cathartically work out what I'm struggling with on my own. Playing a kind of like a nervous character is okay in a movie. A lot of times in a movie, you're playing a character that's nervous because it's like usually the kind of way in for the audience, so that they can see, you know, so that they can kind of be in this crazy world that you're in too. You know, so you have like basically a surrogate for the audience. Except in the movies that John writes, where are the characters, usually the leading characters in your movies are really wonderfully enigmatic, and it's so interesting. As an actor who got to play one, I found it a real acting challenge because there was no requirement for me to kind of show the audience what I was thinking or doing.
But actually, that was, it's funny, I think that one of the exciting things for Kelly and for myself too about having you in that role is that like you can't help but appear as if you're thinking. Like there is something about, like, I think in all of Jesse's roles where there are clearly like gears going in there, and like we might not know exactly what those thoughts are, but just the sort of intelligence and the criticality is palpable, you know.
Thanks. Can I ask you, because I've always been curious, and it would dovetail from what you asked. When you're writing a character like the character in Night Moves, and just for some background, my character works on a farm, but he's also plotting to blow up a dam because he's an environmentalist and an activist. But yet, as an audience, we're never kind of let into his emotional kind of inner life or his backstory.
I mean, this might have been a mistake. Like, I just presume that everyone wants to blow up the industrial infrastructure, you know? And as it turned out, that wasn't the case. Like, a lot of people were like, I don't understand why he's doing that. And it's like, don't you, want to go destroy that stuff? But, so that just could have been a slight error.
No. That's
but enough. Also, but on a larger scale, like, I mean, I think, or on a larger, in a larger way, Kelly, the director of that film, is a very special and amazing kind of director who actually trusts like the language of cinema and like the things that an image can do without a bunch of talking going on. And she, is one of the few people who will just literally hold a shot long enough for the audience to like have their own thought during the thing. So I mean, part of it is just, when someone is making a film that elapses in a kind of human scale, a lot of that thinking just sort of happens, and we're forced to kind of do it ourselves a little bit, but it doesn't have to be, just this like constant exposition or characters saying exactly what is obvious that they would be feeling, like, oh, yeah, you're going to be blowing up a dam, like, that would probably be pretty nerve-wracking. Like, we don't need to talk about it all the time. Just seeing them do it is like crazy. So, I think it's. I mean, I think the language that Kelly speaks as a director is like almost, it's almost like a separate language than most filmmakers. It's just so rare.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so she could just point the camera at you and it was great. Yeah. I mean, you did a lot of great stuff too.
Hey, thanks.
Also, I'll say that Jesse was one of the few, I think you probably are the only actor who ever has gotten through any edits onto the script. You know, usually it's like, no interest. But Jesse had really great ideas and actually rewrote some scenes that were like so much better afterwards.
Originally wanted to build a dam. I said,
yeah.
I don't know. I think it would be more interesting. Just hear me out. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, should we go to another?
Yeah, sure. Other.
Can you point us to some of your favorites and Bream Gives Me Hiccups?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm just trying to think. I'm just thinking because it's in different sections. So I really like this one called A Post-Gender Normative Man Tries to Pick Up a Woman at a Bar, because it's about a guy who's trying to kind of eschew gender norms. He's so embarrassed that he's a man, and but he's also trying to pick up a woman at a bar, which necessarily requires him to be the man in the situation. And so he is like constantly apologizing for his own masculinity whilst trying to pick up a woman at a bar. I like that one, and then I like that there's a kind of a longer one, which is like an extended email exchange between me and my first girlfriend, which then gets interrupted, and we kind of have a little bit of like a teenage lover's spat, because I feel like maybe she's cheating on me with some guy up at camp, and then my older sister comes home from college where she's getting a PhD in the Bosnian genocide, and she takes over the email exchange, having read all the threads, and she compares each person in our teenage lives based on the email thread to different players in the war in Bosnia, kind of trying to figure out actually who's in the wrong. You don't have to know anything about the Bosnian War. I mean, I do because I'm interested in it, but it's part of the joke is that these references get increasingly obscure as my sister's arguments become more and more pointed about this kind of juvenile relationship. And I like that because I'm able to kind of like bring in things I'm interested in ways that are accessible to maybe if you don't know about it, you can still enjoy it and it's not offensive to Bosnians because it's like a well-researched piece.
I wondered, yeah.
I wonder if it's a euphemism for it. Probably not.
No, I didn't. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hi there.
When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be on the Phoenix Suns, and little did I know that my height at that age would be my final one. And it's hard when you watch basketball, you're usually watching from above and you have kind of no gauge, but if you ever go to the games, they're real big. And so I was desperate to be a basketball player and I really kind of worked out my life. Like I thought I'd have a house in Scottsdale just because it was a short enough commute. And at some point you realize like, it's funny, like at some point, like I noticed this as an actor almost more than any other profession, is that the world will tell you what you are way more than you'll have the opportunity to make a case for yourself. And actors more so than anybody are told what they are because you're being evaluated holy. Your face, your body, your hair, everything. And so, like, I have this image in my head of myself, and then say, oh, with the, oh, okay, oh, he got sent the script playing nerd. I'm like, how strange. Oh. Well, this must be a mistake. And then you're like, you have a meeting with the person. It's like, oh, it's a good script. You have a meeting with the person. They're like, you're perfect for this role. You're the only person we thought of. You're like, oh, that's horrible. That's horrible. Quick question. Who's playing Cool Man in Leather Jacket? I'm like, you're like, oh, that's, oh, Channing Tatum. You're like, why, maybe he'd want to play my role and I could play his role. I even own a leather jacket. I say, do you really? I say, no, it's pleather. And so they say, okay. So, yes, and so it's funny, like, acting as, you really have to kind of come to terms with yourself, but the great thing about acting is you can kind of, if you have, like, enough success with play, you know, I find, like, you can start to take advantage and tailor your skill set to other things if you're savvy and if you make some good decisions. So, like, a lot of, I noticed, like, Jewish performers, they would have, you know, changed their name, like Woody Allen, when it was kind of not great to be a Jewish person. I think this repeated itself. So I was friends with Terrence Howard, and he told me that that trend ended up repeating itself in the black community with a lot of, you know, black actors and rappers having to change their names to a more kind of like performer type name, like Cedric the Entertainer. But a lot of times what happens if... No, I'm saying in the same way Jews would have to be, you know, like a Woody Allen or you know, or what's his name, Sid Caesar or something. And what happens is once you pass the kind of, like, let's say, the hegemonic kind of white society saying, like, oh, you're entertaining enough, you can come in, then you start changing your name, you start making more serious things, you know, and then you're kind of, you're known, you know, in a more serious way.
So when you approach... acting or writing, how do you approach it? Like, do you generally come from the same viewpoint?
Yes. Yes, I try to think of like what would be most entertaining given the context and the texture of the piece. So in John's wonderful script, Night Moves, there was no reason for me to be funny. And in fact, Kelly and I often, because Kelly and John are really funny people, but Kelly Reichardt, the director of the movie that John wrote, she doesn't want any humor, no levity. She says she thinks it'll kind of ruin the movie because you have this wonderful, thrilling momentum and then suddenly somebody has some kind of like, you know, eye roll acknowledging their crazy plight. And it kills it. And so, but I really love that too. In my stuff, there's like, it's funny. It's more, there's more humor because it's just what I'm instinctively geared toward. But I love going into a movie like John's and doing the most dramatic performance and never feeling like I'm compromising anything or never feeling like, I wish I was funny. I have no desire to do that if the piece doesn't warrant it. And I find what's really enjoyable about that, which is kind of getting into the mindset of somebody who is just full of rage and anxiety and it's all misplaced. So those are different kind of processes, but ultimately to achieve the same goal of kind of thinking of a person, understanding what drives them, and kind of finding the nuance of their psychology.
Are there other, like, humor writers that you admire, like, living or dead? I mean, Woody Allen is an interesting reference point, you know, and does, yeah, have a certain, like, particularly Jewish sort of sensibility. Like, I just wonder if there are other people who you have, like, really responded to in that way.
Yes, my favorite, I would say, short humor writer, which I would aspire to do what he does, is this guy Ben Greenman. Now, I read his stuff on McSweeney's, and I really love, there are great comedic writers on McSweeney's. Simon Rich is a friend of mine, and he's funnier than I'll ever be, but I'm trying to do something a little different than him. Dan Kennedy is funny. There's all these really funny people that write for The New Yorker and for McSweeney's. But what's different about Ben Greenman is that he is able to infuse pathos in a very, unusual and surprising way. He wrote, to me, my favorite kind of short humor pieces are these things on McSweeney's called Letters from an Earthball, which are these stories from an earthball who is locked in the closet of a high school gym. And the earthball is like the ball that kids throw around in gym class when it's raining. And it seems like this just the most absurd premise, and the character is inundated with Fox News because the gym teacher always has Fox News on. So the gym teacher walks in and out of the room, but this sweet little ball is constantly exposed to it. So he develops these very strong opinions about the news. And And yet the character is the most lovable creature, more lovable than, you know, a character that's in a dramatic story. Like, you just, right. And so that's what I really love, and that's kind of what I tried to do with this, is to have characters that are funny and have situations that are absurd and premises that are original, but to try as much as possible to infuse them with real, heartbreaking turns.
Yeah, you do.
Hi.
Yes, Jesse, did you have your quick witticisms and rapid rate of speech from when you were very young, or was it more an evolution of living in your family, repartee with your family, or from becoming an actor, reading other humorous writers, and being around producers?
Yeah, it's those producers. I'll tell you, they I'll tell you, that casting couch makes you. No, I was very quiet as a kid and very sad as a kid. I missed a year of school because I was so depressed. They gave me a tutor and I went to a mental place. I was a very sad, quiet kid. And then after high school, I started acting and I got some more confidence. And I found that my personality, while most often grating, can find a home in things like this where it's not grating because you came to listen. Now, if I was with any of you one-on-one, I can assure you this would be exhausting. But in the context that we've all agreed upon, it's entertaining. So I have two friends, a tolerant girlfriend, and a family that tries to avoid me. And that's because I don't stop. But that only came kind of after high school when I started getting a little confidence in kind of my personality not being something to be ashamed of, but my mind to be something that can be, you know, kind of fun to have. Thanks a lot.
That was an uplifting ending, I feel like.
Yeah,
that was warmed my heart. Thank you guys all for coming out, and thank you, Jesse, so much for coming all the way out for doing this. So great.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, John.
That was Jesse Eisenberg and John Raymond in conversation at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2015. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.